Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello and welcome to Nature Now for the third week of January 2018. I'm your host, Paul Rubin. Today, I'm delighted to introduce our guest, John Marsluff. John is a professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington, leading or co-author of books such as Gifts of the Crow, Avian Ecology and Conservation in Urbanizing World, and Welcome to Suburbia. He is a leader of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's recovery team for the critically endangered Mariana Crow and has appeared on TEDx Rainier in a PBS Nova episode entitled Bird Brain. Today, we will be talking with John about corvids and avian intelligence. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. That familiar caw may be a little bit more complex than you think. This species, or potential subspecies to a more common North American bird, is specific to the Pacific Northwest and can be found in urban areas and along the shoreline of Alaska. They are black, found in small to medium-sized flocks, nest on coastal islands, and migrate inland in the winter. You can observe them forage by walking on the ground, and their flight pattern is a regular and repeating wing beat, with infrequent gliding or soaring when able. I've had the opportunity to make a few observations while hiking these past few weeks. One that sticks out in my mind was a brief hike along the sandspit of Fort Flagler. It was a gloomy day with only a handful of other visitors at the park. Port Townsend was seen gently floating above the fog of Port Townsend Bay. The tide was very low and continuing to ebb. Two pairs of harlequin ducks were casually foraging near the shoreline. This was a delightful sight because I had recently found video of perhaps the same two pairs 2 years ago, before I was aware of their identity. That gave me high hopes of viewing their mosaic of slate blue, deep orange, and a white patch in front of their eyes at a close range, something I haven't been so lucky at other common viewing areas. Surf scoters and harbor seals drifted with the current, followed closely by three-horned grebes. A bald eagle soared above the spit, looking for preoccupied prey. Pelagic, double-crested, and branch cormorants competed over the top position on wood pilings. Dunlins, sanderlings, and black-bellied plovers foraged along the shoreline. I found out the next day that two red knots were observed at the very same location. These red knots were in the process of making the largest annual migration of any bird species, a potential 9,300 miles from its Arctic nest to wintering ground at the southernmost extent of South America. Charlie, would you like to give us some other news and observations?
The Peninsula Daily News has reported, and some SQUIM residents may already be aware, that there has been a steady rise of trumpeter swans in our area. Volunteers of the Christmas Bird Count in SQUIM recorded populations of 179 on January 9th and 181 on January 12th. This is great news, considering that in 2011, specific swan counts were conducted by the Audubon Society. The State Fish and Wildlife also provided a grant to the Northwest Swan Conservation Foundation to assist Audubon in recording swan populations after a decline in population from lead poisoning. There's also been a noticeable change in wintering locations after the Elwha Dam was removed in 2011, which has shifted the swans' attention to flooded agricultural land. Attempts are being made to lessen potential conflict between humans and swans. The most recorded observations have been made in agricultural areas of Port Williams, between Lots Gessel and Anderson Road, and throughout the shoreline of Dungeness Bay in SQUIM. Other locations to see the trumpeter swans before they migrate back to Canada and Alaska include Knapp Road north of Highway 101 between Gardner and Blinn and West Valley south of Chimicum on Center Road.
And now for the conversation interview with John Marsluff. Can you give our listeners a brief explanation of the Corvidae family?
Sure. Corvidae is a family of birds that exists around the world. They're on all the continents except Antarctica. There's around 150 species in this family, and they comprise kind of common types of birds that we think of as jays, crows, ravens, magpies, nutcrackers, and the like.
Which species of corvids do we have in the Pacific Northwest?
Here we have a fine diversity of most of those different member groups. We've got kind of on the more arid side of the mountains and further south, we have scrub jays and also black-billed magpies on the east side of the Cascades. We have American crows and common ravens in kind of the lowland areas where cities are, and up through the mountains the raven exists. As you get into more forested areas, we have two jays at a lower elevation. We have Steller's jays, and at the upper elevations, gray jays. And then we have Clark's nutcrackers as well, which are a higher elevation, kind of along in the same habitats as gray jays. And the nutcracker specializes on harvesting and caching and living off of pine seeds.
What separates corvids from other families of birds?
There's not a specific feature, I would say, that sets corvids apart from everybody else. So they have a common ancestor. They share DNA within the group more than between other groups of birds. That's how they're technically classified. But some general characteristics are they're relatively large birds. They have pronounced bills that they use in a variety of ways, either harvesting seeds like the nutcracker or scraping carrion off the highway like a magpie or a raven might do. They're kind of general in their build. They have good flight abilities, really great skills at adapting to changes in their environment because they have large brains for their body size. And they are kind of a multi-purpose sort of animal, very good at taking advantage of the things that people do to their environment, the foods we leave around, the new opportunities we make. And some of them are also quite specialized. So the gray jay and the Clark's nutcracker are highly specialized on finding carrion or harvesting pine seeds, respectively.
I think a lot of people consider their intelligence to be a defining feature. I think, like humans, we're both able to adapt in both a facultative way. How have crows and humans co-evolved?
Well, I would say the crows, and those are around the world, again, in the northern hemisphere for the most part. The jays are more distributed in the southern hemisphere, their kind of center of radiation. But crows and humans have had a long history because we basically evolved in the same parts of the world. And I believe crows and some of the early ravens specialized on people. When we first evolved, even 7 million years ago, we came on the scene. We were a pretty ineffective hunter. We were a scavenger ourselves. And we were often in the company of crows and ravens as we tried to feed ourselves. And those birds undoubtedly saw us as a great opportunity to steal food from us, to challenge us, and to raid our agriculture when we became more agricultural. And they've continued to adapt and evolve with our food kind of foraging strategies, I guess I would say, throughout our evolutionary history. That's led to a lot of different innovations in people, maybe storing food to keep it out of the way of scavengers like crows, having scarecrows or crow boys in the fields to keep the crows away from our food, building images of people into the salmon drying racks of the early people in the Nea Bay area, for example, close to you. That was done to keep ravens from stealing drying salmon. So many ways these animals have kind of forced our hand and made us better at what we do, more efficient at our food gathering and storage. And then they've also, because of that, imbued us with traditions and cultures that we've also basically co-evolved with them. And things like seeing the raven or the crow as a creator or provider or a trickster, those are all sorts of beliefs and feelings that came about in people as they dealt with these very smart and curious animals.
Yeah, great answer. They seem extremely social, too. A lot of poetry has been inspired by them, and you see a lot of their imagery in a lot of different cultures, like the ones you gave examples of. What inspired your interest for studying birds, bird intelligence, and bird conservation?
Well, I tell you, I had a fantastic high school biology teacher that got me very inspired about doing field work. He'd take us out on field trips on the weekends. We'd catch snakes. We'd count birds. We'd watch nesting hawks and all sorts of things. So he kind of got me on the path to biology. I was fortunate to have a new and energetic professor in college who was an ornithologist, and he focused my interest much more on birds. And in grad school, I just lucked into a situation, to be quite honest, where I got to my advisor's lab, and he had this long-term projects on a species of jay, the pinion jay in Arizona. And he said, why don't you take a look at that and continue this line of work? And that was the hook, basically. I started watching those birds. They are extremely social. They live long term. They're very smart. They remember where they store thousands of seeds every year. And they live in these extended kind of human-like societies where you have families and close allies within the society. So once you kind of get into that in a professional setting, then you tend to stick with it. And that allowed me to look at questions about intelligence and interesting behavior, but also conservation, because unfortunately, in some places, mainly Pacific Islands, some of the crows are highly endangered. And so the expertise I had on mainland birds transferred to being able to help out with some of the endangered island birds as well.
And you mentioned Pinyon Jay. I know that you're the author of a book entitled Pinyon Jay. I'd love to give that a read soon. I've gone over some of your other books, and I've actually got a jay story of my own. I've banded, I guess technically assisted in banding, Florida scrub jay.
Yeah,
my roots are in Florida. Such an interesting bird to just view, observe, or actually get to interact with. But Florida scrub jays, they're known for flying and landing on your shoulder. You can see them communicating between one another. They work as such a good group of, I guess, family members, and they have like a lookout. They breed in a group. They're a big concern in Florida right now, just based off their scrub habitat and development. Yeah. They're just such an intelligent bird species, and we really like to conserve them. I know that California has an island. Is it the California scrub jay?
It's the island scrub jay.
Island scrub jay. Yeah.
Well, my advisor was very good friends with Glenn Wolfenden, the Florida scrub jay guy who started that study. My first professional meeting I went to, I participated in carrying both my advisor and Glenn down to a large party in the basement of the American Ornithologist Society meeting one year. So it's on my shame list. I've never seen a Florida scrub jay, but I know the work very well and know the guys down there very well. It's really a great project. That was cool you were able to participate in it.
Yeah, and I could give you a list of 20 different places that just you're going to see them, just because if you kind of make that fishing noise, the psh, psh, if you make a disturbance, they're going to come out and they're going to kind of, yeah, you know, they're going to find you. So, yeah. And that's another part of why they work so good as a group, what makes them so unique, I think. But not so unique for jays or the corvid family, just that for Florida, they're a very specific species and they look different. You can definitely enjoy just watching them. Can you describe any interesting methodology or conclusion from past research that you've done at the University of Washington?
I guess a couple of things. One interesting study we did was testing the ability of these birds to recognize particular individuals. And we did that by catching birds and wearing a mask, a specific mask when we caught them, and then walking around campus later with that mask and seeing if the birds would respond to us differently than if we didn't wear the mask, or if we wore a different type of mask. And that was kind of a fun project, a kind of a one-off thing. I thought, oh, this will be cool. We always suspected they could recognize us, but this was a way to test it. And in fact, they did recognize us, but unfortunately, they still recognize us. And I'm going into year 12 next month of the time since I captured the first birds with that mask, and still they respond to me. So what I thought was a simple, fun experiment has turned out to be a much longer-term experiment than I ever had imagined. And it also led into, I think, actually really interesting work that has been facilitated by a university like the University of Washington, where there's lots of different experts and devices around. And we've been able to do some brain imaging work now on crows and showed what part of the brains were used when they recognize people that have captured them or people that have been friendly with them, how they respond to dangers like hawks or the sight of a dead crow. And this has really allowed us in a fairly non-invasive way to understand how their big brains really work. And to put it simply, they work pretty much like ours do. The same parts are used to remember and recognize threats and rewards in their environment.
Yeah, and to pass information past generation, I think, is just such an amazing attribute for a species like that, to communicate like danger or like just a specific thing like a certain mask. I think that's pretty interesting. I know that they also are one of few animals besides humans to use tools.
That's true. We're looking at that. That's mainly from the New Caledonia crow. One of my grad students, Loma Pendergraf, has just trained some American crows to use a tool, and they pick up stones and drop them in a tube of water to raise the water to get food that they can't reach,
wow,
like Aesop's fable suggested. And we've just gotten the first birds to actually do that, and we'll be scanning them as they contemplate that task, scanning their brains to see what part of the brain is involved in that really kind of higher cognitive ability.
You're definitely one of the biggest experts in our area. What can our listeners take away from your experiences the next time they encounter a species in the Corvidae family?
Well, I think you could look at them from like three dimensions. First off, most of them are extremely beautiful. I mean, magpies, the purple and greenish sheen is something to behold. All the jays are gorgeous. Even the crow and the raven, which look to be just black birds, are really quite iridescent if you get a look at them in the sun. So take away a beautiful animal, an incredibly smart animal. As you said, they use tools and they live in groups and they learn from one another. They live a long time and they gather this information and kind of store it for their lifetimes, which can be decades. And then finally, I guess I would take from them that they are not just part of the environment that's like a rock as you walk by. They're instead a part that's really checking you out. Yeah. They are looking at you possibly as a food source. Think about gray jays. If you go up into the mountains, they seem to find you and follow you for food. Or if you're in the city or along the coast, a crow or a raven is definitely looking at you. They are aware of you being there, and they are either seeing you as a potential food source or as a potential enemy. So be careful what you do around them, because they will remember and kind of mark you with that behavior for a long time.
Yeah, definitely. Even today, I was over at, we have a lagoon right down the road, a Kai Tai Lagoon, and was just doing a little birding before coming here today. I noticed a group of American crows, and they're not just being loud. They're not just trying to cause a ruckus. They're communicating between each other. They're flicking their tails. They're definitely conveying a message, and I think there's just so much more to it than just being like a background noise. I like to almost focus on that stuff when I am going outside, because it could mean a predator in the area. It could mean a bunch of different animals just making their way through. You mentioned the beautiful colors that they have, that iridescence, and I have a non-birding friend. She's getting more into it, and I'm not like a birder, but I really enjoy going outside and seeing the different colored birds and like learning their ecology. She loves stellar jays. She loves that transition between that blue, that really dark blue, and then into that black. They're a very beautiful bird, and they're also very loud, and I notice that they're always the loudest birds on our property. You can definitely find some beauty in it, but I like them because they usually do call out other birds or other animals in the area, like I was saying. So,
great way to see hawks and owls, for sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Or bobcats. I remember a fun time when I was surveying birds around here, and I heard the crows coming and scolding, like you say, and just kind of waited, and they came closer and closer, and finally a bobcat came just kind of prancing right by me on the trail, and the crows were all right behind the bobcat, just signaling his presence. It was awesome.
That's going to conclude our conversation. I just want to thank you again for coming on. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Let's hear that mystery sound again. That was the harsh, nasally caw of the northwestern crow, a small crow that resides perhaps exclusively along the northern Pacific Ocean of Alaska. The northwestern crow may be a sub or identical species of the American crow, which is almost identical besides its larger body and less nasally but equally harsh caw. Let's have a quick listen to an American crow typical caw. American crows have over 20 known calls and sometimes include a subsong, or a combination of hoarse coos, caws, and rattles and clicks that can quietly ramble on for minutes. They are long-legged, thick-necked, and have a heavy bill. American crows are a very social species and can have flock sizes in the thousands. John, would you like to add a response about the similarities between northwestern and American crows?
Sure. Recent genetic analysis by Dave Slager and John Klicka at the Burke Museum here has shown that really northwestern crows don't exist here anymore, and they may not really exist as a species at all. Presumably, several million years ago when crows came across Beringia and they started to diversify into the American crow and the fish crow on the eastern seaboard, the Pacific coastland was occupied by another species that was starting to specialize on tideland areas, and that would become the northwestern crow. And there are some differences in vocalization and social organization in size, but all of that seems to be clinal, and it's just a function of a smaller, more nasally sounding bird on the coast, which is not an unusual thing for birds. What seems to be indicated now is that when urbanization really kicked off here in the 50s and 60s, and when agricultural activity across southern Canada and American Great Plains has basically increased treed vegetation so that crows and barred owls and things like that could move west, the American crow, in fact, moved west from the east, then settled in our cities and agricultural lands and interbred with anything that might have been a unique northwestern crow here. So genetically, that unique trajectory of evolution has been basically swamped by all the genes from American crows from the eastern U.S. And so what Dave and John have found is that basically there's a large introgression of American crow genes all the way up into northern Canada and southeast Alaska. And perhaps up in those farther northern areas, there might be what you'd consider a unique genotype of a northwestern crow. But because it interbreeds so easily with the American crow, it probably wouldn't qualify as being called a distinct species by our criteria anymore.
Maybe at one point there was a specific species out here, but at this point now it's just interbred so much that it's just not that species anymore. And maybe there's this small isolated population in Alaska or northern Canada, but not quite here or really anywhere at this point.
Certainly not here. And I think the key thing to keep in mind is that the way we look at species now, that's basically it's a process rather than an endpoint. And that process is always birds or animals in general are getting more distinct or less distinct from their closest relatives. And as they get more distinct, there comes a point where we say, all right, they're unique species. But at any time, you could have introgression of new genes from other species that would reduce the distinctiveness, or maybe greater isolation because of human activities that increase that distinctiveness. So this is a process that goes on, and we've documented in, of course, lots of species over time. And it's just the point we're seeing right now with the northwestern crow is that it's losing genetic distinctiveness compared to what it had when there wasn't as much crow habitat in the West Coast. Basically, when you had all forests here, heavy forests, that's not American crow habitat. And those birds would not have gotten here. Only place crows would have been were right along the coast. But as we opened those up and facilitated movement from the east, now we had all these genes come in basically with the American crow.
Yeah, so when we talked about coevolution between humans and crows earlier, what a better example than their ability to migrate over here or just establish over here, but from the east. Thank you for that. That's a very interesting look at it, and I think we can take a lot away from that. And thank you to the Cornell Ornithology Lab Macaulay Library and allaboutbirds.com for sound recordings and descriptions. For upcoming events, Charlie, do you want to start us off?
The Jamestown Sklallam Tribe and North Olympic Salmon Coalition are looking for volunteers to help plant native trees along floodplains of the Dungeness River on Saturday, February the 3rd. Floodplains are an ecologically significant service that provide habitat for wildlife, take on excess water during flooding events, reduce risk of damage from high water along riverbanks, and act as a buffer to rivers for nutrient and pollutant storage for proper water quality. The event will be from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on February 3rd and will include light refreshments and hot drinks. Bring warm, waterproof clothes and boots, water, and a lunch. To receive directions, please RSVP to Katie at outreach@nosc.org or 360-504-5611.
Visit Cornell Lab's Bird Academy and become a better birder. Bird Academy is currently offering courses on feeder birds, how to identify bird song, hawk and raptor identification, shorebird identification, duck and waterfowl identification, warbler identification, and bird biology. I took the duck and waterfowl course and found it very helpful.
The Marine Science Center will be holding a new volunteer information session between 10 a.m. and noon on February the 10th. You can find the session at the Natural History Exhibit Classroom Building 502 in Fort Worden. Learn about citizen science and the opportunities available.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 p.m. on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM on Thursdays at 5:05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Magpie, sung by Ian Tyson.
Bold chastiser magpie, always waking up my wife and I. You old coyote in the sky, magpie.
Some say
you're a bold deceiver. I say you're a true believer. The West ain't never gonna die, just as long as